Catherine Mayer is an author and award-winning journalist. Her career has spanned jobs at The Economist, Focus, and Time magazine. She's a founding committee of WOW, Women of the World Festival. She is a co-founder with Sandy Tosvig of the Women's Equality Party, and now its president. In March 2015 at London's WOW Festival, Catherine Mayer accidentally founded the Women's Equality Party. That's one of my favourite lines. But we're here today to talk about her book, which has just come out, called Attack of the 50-Foot Women. Hi, and welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you.
So what's stunning about it is the cover. It is a very 1950s kitsch cover, but then if you look closely, it's actually quite disturbing, and it actually reminds me quite a lot of the horrors that happened yesterday in Westminster. There's a giantess, I would call her, on the cover, clutching a mobile, but she's above a bridge, and underneath her are some army vehicles. There's people, there's a woman clapping, there's men terrified, there's bombs going off, there's fire. It looks like a 1950s kitsch B-movie. Tell me what's behind this cover, which is very evocative.
Well, it's actually a new take on a 1958 movie poster. The original movie, the 1958 movie, was Attack of the 50-Foot Woman, singular, whereas my book is Attack of the 50-Foot Women, plural, and my subtitle, I think, gives away quite a lot about the content, how gender equality can save the world, exclamation mark. The original movie is one that I had in mind when I started writing this book, because it is a parable of the terror that people felt about the idea of women gaining power and agency and what they might do with it. It's a story about a woman who goes for a drive in the desert at night, encounters a space alien, grows to 50 foot tall, and uses that power to destroy. She kills her husband, she kills his mistress, and ends up dying herself. And for me, of course, the power of women unleashed is not something frightening, but something devoutly to be wished, and something that I believe would help everyone. In the original poster, you see her, this 50-foot woman, is actually causing damage. She's causing havoc. She is also dressed rather provocatively. When she grows to 50 foot tall, she's in her bedroom, so the only thing she can find to wear is an arrangement of bed sheets. In this case, our woman is, in fact, you described the scenes of devastation behind her, but she's fixing things.
Oh,
and the men are not, in fact, cowering. The men are looking on in amazement, and in some cases in enthusiasm. I talked to the designers quite carefully about what it was we wanted to show. But yes,
I think yesterday, obviously, what happened yesterday with the terror attack, I'm slightly more aware of bridges and things and the army. What are the army vehicles then? Are they?
Well, that's a take on the original poster. So one of the many ideas I explore in the book is whether women use power differently from men, and whether they would be less likely to embark on military adventures, what does female leadership look like? But most importantly, in the last chapter, I take you on a tour of a gender equal world, because this is something that nobody can imagine, because there is no gender equal society anywhere on our planet.
What about
currently
Sweden? Aren't they quite up there?
The Nordic countries are much more advanced than the UK in many ways, but they are nowhere near gender equality. In fact, Iceland is the world's most gender equal nation, according to the World Economic Forum's rankings. Iceland has topped those rankings for gender equality for the past 7 years. But what actually is true is that Iceland still has a 14% gender pay gap, it still has a gender segregated labour market, and it still has quite high levels of gender-based violence against women and girls. So although it has made a lot of progress, in particular around things like parenting and caregiving, where men do a lot more than women, it is still a long way from gender equality. So in my final chapter, I take us on a tour of the gender equal future we could have.
Don't you call it Equalia, or is that the name?
I call it, I call it Equalia. I was on Woman's Hour the other day, and the very nice presenter told me that it was Equalia, and that was BBC pronunciation. So I'm glad to see that it's already become such a kind of establishment concept that there is a proper pronunciation.
And didn't you make this word up when you were in your early teens?
I don't know when I came up with the word, but I have been thinking about what the gender equal future would be like for a long time, but I also thought we'd be there by now. So part of the reason that Sandy Toksvig and I co-founded the Women's Equality Party, and part of the reason why I've written this book and why I campaign, is because I went from a position of thinking that this future was coming our way anyway, to realizing that we actually have to work quite hard in order to achieve it, and that some of the advances that we have made and some of the protections that women enjoy are actually under threat now. So we not only need to fight for what we have, but we need to fight for what we already have.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting because in the first chapter you say, women nowadays, you know, I'm one of them, I'm middle class, I live in West London, I've got my own business, you know, and I'm thinking, hey, it's a really good time to be a woman, be a feminist. But you say, hang on a minute, we've got so much further to go, don't sit on your laurels.
Yes, and also the experience of women like you, or indeed like me, is not by any means universal, and our fates are interconnected, but we're all missing out because of the failure to reach gender equality. You are, as you have just described yourself, a woman of privilege in many ways, but you are still part of the same statistic that says one in five women are likely to be sexually assaulted during her lifetime.
Happened to me, yeah.
Well, I mean, and we all take it, we all almost accept that as part of life, and we shouldn't be accepting that. And it is something that is damaging absolutely everyone. But I also don't believe that because we are more, you know, that people who are more comfortable than other people should just accept that either. I mean, it is a matter of social justice to bring about gender equality, but it is also a matter of self-interest, which is something that I point out rather vigorously to every man with whom I discuss this, because in economic terms, the increased participation of women in the workforce means actually economic growth, means a better economy. And all the institutions that are not working very well at the moment would work so much better if they actually managed to harness the talents of women as well as men.
What proof have you got about this? How do you know it would be better?
I've summoned one of the reasons I've written the book is to bring together the huge reams of research on this subject. So, you know, it's revolutionary types of organizations, like, you know, sort of big accountancy firms, and, you know, we're not talking disputed information here, even though you will get people who like to pretend that the gender pay gap doesn't exist. You know,
are they men particularly or not?
They very often are, and they will also say things like, they'll say, well, there's a gender pay gap, but it's only because women are choosing to be part-time or lower paid, and ignoring the pressures that are on women in terms of the idea, for example, that somehow women have children but men don't. You know, the weird doublethink that goes on, and also the ways in which employers actually tend to pay women less even if those women don't have children. And interestingly, they pay men with children more than they pay men without children, because there is some unconscious bias that still sees the man as the head of the family and therefore the primary earner, and rewards him accordingly. And so, I mean, there is so much research on all of this. There's so much research both on the structural disadvantages that women are at, and just so much research about how much more effective the institutions that companies are if they have more diverse workforces, not just, by the way, in boardrooms. This isn't just about the people at the top. This is about people all the way through the organisations. And nobody can look at our political system at the moment and say that it's working well. You know, part of the many votes that we've seen obviously the US election, potentially around Brexit, a lot of the reasons people voted the way that they did had to do with a general dissatisfaction with politics and a feeling that their views are not sufficiently represented. And it's not surprising that they feel that way, because the political classes are deeply unrepresentative of the populations that they purport to represent. And there are a whole set of reasons for that that I lay out in the book, not just things like voting systems, but the extraordinary expense of doing politics, the unnecessary expense, which also keeps out women for a whole host of different reasons.
So should women become more politicised?
Well, women are becoming more politicised. One of the things that you saw with the election of Donald Trump was that realisation, that was one that I had already talked about having myself, that gender equality is not coming our way. Things are not only not necessarily going to get better, but they are in many cases getting worse. You see in the States reproductive rights being rolled back. You see potentially through Brexit, and this is an interesting one, although there have been, Theresa May is saying it will not affect women's rights that were originally guaranteed through Europe, but actually she hasn't grappled with the question of secondary legislation, where actually think rules can be changed without reference to Parliament in ways that could actually take away rights that we already have. And so these are all things that we have to be very much aware of. And women are aware of it, and men are aware of it. You saw the huge women's marches, also attended by a lot of men. We at the Women's Equality Party have seen a huge surge in interest. I mean, we've always grown fast, but we had 1,000 new members in the 4 days after Trump was elected. And there is very much a feeling that activism is necessary, but the questions people are asking us now, they used to say, is the Women's Equality Party necessary? They now say, how fast can you make change, and what can we do to help? And it's that what can we do question that we're addressing most urgently now. So we're doing things like running activism camps to train people, to give people the tools for activism.
So tell me about those. I'm intrigued.
Well, those are being launched across the UK this summer, and basically there's details on our website, but anybody can sign up and learn, you know, spend a weekend learning the best ways to be an activist.
Now, if I vote women's equality, does that mean I'm not voting then for Labour or Liberal, or do you know what I mean? Does that mean, do I lose my vote to another party?
Not necessarily at all. I mean, one of the things about the way that we decided to do politics differently, when we launched, we opened our membership to members of other parties too, and we are very actively exploring different ways of collaborating with those parties where they are doing good things and where we can work together to amplify voices in favour of gender equality. And just for example, when the Brexit vote was going through Parliament, we drafted an amendment on that issue, secondary legislation. It was put forward for us by Caroline Lucas and of the Green Party, and it was signed by members of Labour, the Lib Dems, the Greens and the SNP in Plaid Cymru, making it the amendment that had the biggest cross-party support of any amendment. We absolutely believe in collaborative politics. However, we also felt it very necessary to be a party and to challenge the other parties at the ballot box, as well as offering to work with them and encouraging them to take our policies. Because if you don't do that, they tend to too often pay lip service to the issue of gender equality. And I had noticed in 2015 that the parties, instead of challenging UKIP on its platform as it gained electoral as it gained support, were contorting themselves to become more like UKIP. So that is the one respect in which I took My inspiration from UKIP was I thought if we challenge them in the same way, they will start trying to take gender equality more seriously, trying to be more like us.
Yeah, debate it in Parliament, put things through more. Yeah.
So this is a long answer to your question about do you lose your vote to another party? The answer is, by voting for us, I think you make those other parties better, because the more support that we get, the more that they will take gender equality seriously. But it also depends on the election. So we ran in May 2016 in the London mayoral and London Assembly elections, and across the Welsh Assembly and Scottish Parliament elections. And those are all elections with an element of where you had more than one vote.
Where you could vote,
in London you had actually four votes even. You had two for the mayor and one for the constituency and one for the list. And we ran a rather unprecedented campaign where we actually only asked for half of your votes. And we had people like Lily Allen, for example, the singer, who did an advert for us where she was giving half of her votes to Labour and half of her votes to us. And we had people giving half of their votes to a lot of different parties and half their votes to us. And based on that campaign and what we were asking for, we not only got more than 350,000 votes at our first election, which is an extraordinarily good impact, but we got the issue of gender equality onto the debates, into all of the manifestos of the other parties, where it had actually been absent until that moment. And Sadiq Khan actually acknowledged that, and he gave his second preference vote to us.
I'm intrigued about you, Catherine. Why are you so interested in gender equality? What's your personal story? What brought you to it?
Well, as I say, I had always rather assumed it was going to happen.
But why? Are you from a background?
I'm originally American, which is why I have the strange accent.
Yeah. And it's a bit like Irish.
And I've lived mostly in this country for a long time now, though I've moved around quite a bit. And I was a journalist for a very long time. And as a journalist, when I first started out, I was very young, and as somebody from an American background, I had sort of bought into the idea that anybody can be president, as it were. And I didn't understand the intricacies of the class system here at all. And that, in a way, protected me, because I went for jobs, including my first job at The Economist, that if I had known the barriers against me getting them, I probably wouldn't have gone for them. And I think I got that first job because they were so surprised that I even thought of applying. But once I was there, the reality of being a young woman in journalism was quite sobering. I was nowhere near as confident as the young men my own age who had all gone to sort of Eton and Oxbridge. But I also did get harassed quite considerably. But I learned to tough it out, and I thought that was what you did. Yeah. I thought playing the game in a way, but toughing it out was an achievement. And it was only as I climbed the ranks of journalism and saw these things still happening to women, and began also, as I got older then, to realise that, of course, that no sooner do you start to get beyond the age where you're harassed, although in fact that still happened right the way through, and I'll tell you something about that in a minute, but that you then also start to suffer from ageism in a way that doesn't impact men in the same way. So, I mean, yes, but it was really looking around and seeing the same things happening to female journalists and realising how few women there were. You know, I got to a very senior level in Time magazine. I was Europe editor for Time magazine, and then eventually editor at large. But even then, the difficulties of getting stories about women, or stories that did not fit into a male idea of what is important, through into the magazine remained considerable. And that actually impacts on all of us too, because women feature far too little in the media generally, and when we do feature, it tends to be as victims or vamps.
Yeah, like a sexy actress or a beautiful this or a
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, I was talking about still being harassed in you know, as I, you know, I'm 56 now and well into my 50s. And the Women's Equality Party ran a campaign last year in which we encouraged women to document the instances of harassment and sexual assault that they'd experienced by writing the postcode where it had happened on their hands, taking a picture, showing it and mapping it. Because the point was that this is absolutely, it is both terribly damaging and restricting for women, but it is also completely routine. And, you know, you don't, none of us know another woman to whom it hasn't happened at least once and very often many times. And when I filled in the postcode where it had happened to me and photographed my hand, the postcode I put was the postcode for the Palace of Westminster, for Parliament. And when I looked online, I was one of, I don't know, 12 women who instantly put that same postcode, because we've all been sexually assaulted or harassed within the Palace of Westminster.
Oh, it is absolutely outrageous. Just say I had a sexist incident this morning. I was on the loo at my home and going to the loo, and it was a number two, and the doorbell rang, and the doorbell rang, and the doorbell rang, and I thought, oh God. So I went down, answered the door. My husband was standing there. I said, what is it? He said, I've forgotten my key. He said, what were you doing? I said, I was on the loo. He said, I've got a job to go to. And I suddenly thought, hang on a minute. And then, because I'm reading this book, I thought, why is your job more important than my job? What's your job, you know? But because he does earn more money, and he is the main breadwinner in the family, which has happened through having children and the, you know, the usual story, he does think that he is more important on some level, you know?
Well, I think that is a problem within a lot of relationships, and a lot of heterosexual relationships. And, you know, I think people do need to work on their partners, but I also understand women who get fed up of explaining things to men. One of the other reasons I wrote this book, is that I'm hoping that a lot of men will read it. So yes, perhaps you can sit down your husband and get him to read it, because a lot of them just don't realise how systematic the discrimination against women is and what it actually looks like. And that's why often, if there is, say, a small incident like the one you're describing, or indeed like a, you know, being whistled at in the street or whatever it is, and you complain about it, men will often say, why do you complain about these small things? And what they don't understand is that it's the accumulation of many small things on a daily basis, day after day, year after year, that actually impacts all women. But, you know, as we were talking about before, you are a woman who is not kind of on the breadline, is not struggling, you're a white woman. You then think about how this impacts women of colour, women with disability, women who are of different sexual orientation, whatever it is, and often the disadvantages intensify and multiply. And, you know, women are on average poorer than men, earn less than men, but there are so many women who are not only on the breadline, but who are also juggling caregiving duties within that context. And it is those women who are the most vulnerable, who are the most time poor, who we most need to engage, but they are also the hardest to engage, to reach.
Yeah, they can't. How are they ever going to find this book? So you've written this book then for men and women.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, in answer to how they're going to find it, I mean, this is a lot of what we are through the party looking at, but also, you know, I'm where I can, I'm donating copies of the book to organisations where those women might see it. But I mean, I'm under no illusion that some of the women are not going to have the time or opportunity to read. But what I'm saying is that kind of bigger picture is you cannot forget at any point that we're not just talking about our own experiences.
We are a group and we've got to stick together in consciousness.
Well, but one of the horrible things that happened in the US election is that whereas 90% of women of colour voted for Hillary Clinton, a majority of white women voted for Donald Trump. And that's something that I tackle in the book to explain that, to explain that we are products of a socialization that tells us that our best option in a way is sticking close to men and is sort of being enjoying the patronage of men. And it's not only not true, but it's also why things don't change. And so, you know, there is a consciousness raising job to do, not only with men, but with a lot of women. A lot of women do not understand how our best interests actually align and do not understand that what they do can damage women who are more vulnerable than they are by enabling the status quo to continue.
Now, lastly, can you just tell us, Aqualia, I don't know if I said it right, Aqualia. Okay. I'm looking forward to seeing it in the dictionary this year. I hope it's like the latest word, you know, they always have that thing. What is your vision, Catherine?
Well, it's not a perfect society. It's not a utopia. Gender equality doesn't necessarily automatically eradicate other kinds of inequality. We have to hope that in asserting in a society that understands that women are as valuable as men should also be one that understands that all people are as valuable as each other. But there will be additional work to do on that. But it is definitely a happier society. It is one more at ease with itself. It is one where relations between the sexes are better. It is not, as some people seem to think, one that has to be policed. Because when you get to gender equality, the kinds of questions about how you use language or what people wear or any of those questions become quite different within a truly gender equal world. And so it's a much more relaxed place, and it's actually a very diverse place, and it's a culturally vibrant place. But as I say, it's not perfect, and I describe some of the imperfections too when I take you on the tour.
So do we have to become 50-foot women, do you think, Catherine?
Not literally, but what we have to do is work together to build a world that can see the achievements of women. I mean, one of the other points is women are doing amazing things. There are metaphorical 50-foot women around us all the time, but because of that media environment I described, where what they do is not considered even worthy of discussion, we don't know about it. We see only those very prominent women leaders, of whom, by the way, people seem to assume there are very many. And in fact, I did the number crunching, and there are fewer than 8% of world leaders are women. So that's in elected positions. But yes, 50-foot, my belief is that 50-foot women, in a metaphorical sense, hold the key to a happier, brighter future for all of us.
Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous. Attack of the 50-Foot Women, How Gender Equality Can Save the World! Is published by HarperCollins. Thank you so much for coming on.
You're welcome. Thank you.